It's time for Twig. This week in Google, Stacey Higginbotham joins Kevin Marks and Jeff Jarvis. We're going to talk about the Google Home device. Is it really a Chromecast in disguise? The new progressive web apps and how it relates to instant web apps and a whole lot more. This week in Google, coming up next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly, CacheFly.com. This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 355, recorded Wednesday, June 1st, 2016. Trigger warning. This Week in Google is brought to you by Tracker. Tracker makes losing things a thing of the past. Pair Tracker to your smartphone, attach it to any item, and find its precise location with the tap of a button. Visit thetracker.com right now to take advantage of their Father's Day limited time sale through June 13th only. Enter promo code TWIG for a free color upgrade. And by Carbonite. Keep your business safe this year. Protect files on your computer or server with automatic cloud backup from Carbonite. Try it free without a credit card at Carbonite.com today. Use the offer code TWIG to get 2 free bonus months when you decide to buy. And by Ministry of Supply. Ministry of Supply uses performance technology to make your work clothes incredibly comfortable. For performance menswear designed to work with your body, visit ministryofsupply.com/twig and use the code TWIG to get 15% off your first purchase. Offer expires June 30th, 2016. It's time for Twig This Week in Google. And Jeff Jarvis is joining us from Berlin. Nice to see you, Jeff. I was worried we wouldn't get you, so I'm thrilled to have you.
Well, I'm delighted to be here as long as the Wi-Fi holds up. But phone lines, tin cans and string, one way or the other, I'll be here.
Yeah, we'll make it work. It's not the same without you, so welcome back. You're gone 1 week last week, and I got the email that said, is Jeff off the show?
Was it wishful thinking?
No. It was like, oh, tell me Jeff's not off the show. I said, no, he's traveling. He'll be back. And I was watching yesterday the new .nyc shows, which you're in beta. You're workshopping, I think, is probably the best
way to
do it.
We're still beta-ing. We're very much beta, but we're figuring things out bit by bit.
Enjoyed it.
So we're working.
You talked a little bit about the story you missed last week, which we'll bring back, the Gawker Teal story.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking teal the color. Also with us, Kevin Marks, good friend of this show.
Yeah.
Hi, Kevin, in his garden.
Yep.
Kevin has
usually
worked.
I'm the pink one. Today, Kevin
it's
is
a little
the pink.
He's using his wife's laptop. That's why. Don't knock it. We're very happy he's here.
Yes.
Kevin has worked everywhere, including Google and Apple. And British Telecom and the Beeb. And he's at KevinMarks.com. And also our newest regular on the show, and it makes me so happy to say that, Stacey Higginbotham.
Yay!
Yay!
I'm like,
but that was lukewarm, Stacey. Are you already tired of us? You're done, aren't you?
Yeah, it's a little awkward.
Yeah. Stacey on IoT.com. She hosts a wonderful Internet of Things podcast with our other good friend, Kevin Toefel. We also love him. And we're thrilled to have you on the show. This is great.
Well, I saw Kevin at I.O., and he was just such a happy guy. He loves working at Google.
Well, he's a consultant, though, right? He's not an employee.
He's a contractor. He's a contractor.
Right,
but he was
a contractor.
Just surrounded by smart people. He was just a happy guy. It was just so good to see.
Well, who wouldn't be happy working at... Oh, sorry, Kevin.
Hey, you know, it's like any job. It's like it depends on who you're working for and who you're working with.
Yeah, yeah.
If you get a manager that doesn't suit you, then you're probably better off leaving.
Yeah, I guess that's the case. Huh? Unfortunately,
yeah.
It just feels like Google would be like magic land, but really, it's probably just no different than Hooli.
Google is very good on the whole. I think they're a good employer in general. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. Now Kevin's never told me, or I don't think even said publicly what he's doing.
It's public now. He works with the Chromecast people.
Oh,
I know. So exciting.
Oh, well, that explains why you on yesterday's IoT show were talking about Google Home, because the story is the new Google Home air freshener slash Echo competitor is really just a Chromecast with a microphone.
That's right. It's got the same silicon base as the Chromecast. And we were, so Kevin and I basically were like, hey, what does this mean? And it actually has a more powerful kind of brains of the operation than the Echo, because the Echo's using a TI OMAP. It's a DaVinci chip. And this, and it runs at like about a gigahertz. And the Chromecast, the current Chromecast is using the Marvell Armada Mini Plus.
And that's, aren't you a geeking out, boy?
I know. I feel like you,
you
know,
have to know this stuff for IoT. This is these are the Intels and the AMDs of IoT.
These are my peeps.
Yeah.
Now I don't know how fast that runs, but it's got to drive an HDMI port, so it needs a little bit more oomph. So I think anyway. Point is, the chips basically, I think it was like $30. You could get the TI version for like $30. It's the most expensive element of the Echo based on the teardowns we've seen. And then the Chromecast chip, we don't know what the price is because Marvell has not put it out there.
But it's the point, I guess, well, first of all, one question that always comes up with the Echo is how much money is Amazon making on this thing? Because they charge $200 now. You and I got it as early adopters for $99, but that went away soon.
Yeah, it's 180, and they don't. When we got it for 99, we got a remote control and the thing, and the remote control is now $30. So if you want the full package that we got, it's like 210. Which I kind of want another Echo, but I don't think I want to pay that much for it.
Well, now would be a bad time.
Now would be a bad time.
Although,
now you get the home.
Well, maybe Jeff Bezos was talking at Recode, right, with Walt Mossberg. And he said he envisioned a world where you had many of these. Like, it wouldn't just be one. You might have a mantelpiece filled with units.
I need air freshener cylinders.
And then you just have to remember who to talk to depending on what you want.
That is like the nightmare scenario.
That doesn't sound like the right thing.
That would
I think you're going to have microphones built into your house, basically, and your car. And, you know, it's Star Trek time. And you're just going to say to the air, hey, blank, give me this.
Right. So the idea...
Have you used the emulator? Have you used the Echo emulator? I didn't get it working yet.
Echo Sim... What is it? .io. It's really designed for people who are designing Echo Tag. Echo, they call them... I don't want to use the word. A-skills. That sounds bad.
That sounds awful.
By the way, and I'm sure, Stacey, you deal with this on your IoT show. What do you do? Do you not say the trigger words?
She who shall not be named.
She who shall... That's a little too long. I'm just going to call
that
it...
That is...
I'm going to say the A skill. and so the idea is you... let me log in with my Amazon account. And I don't think it hurts for anybody to see what my Amazon account is.
We can put things on your wish list.
Yeah.
We can buy your wish list for
you. Yeah. Would you please?
We can just say the magic word and they'll be ordered for you. So.
I know.
I had to happen to be on the Gilmore Gang. I mentioned it and Keith's one started ordering things.
Mine will not do that unless I give it the four-digit passcode, right?
You have to opt into that. That was one of the first things that I did since I have a daughter who has questionable taste in music.
So everybody cover your Echo's ears.
That's true. You can do a trigger warning.
trigger warning. That's good. I like it. We should make an IoT show called Trigger Warning.
Oh, Lord.
What should I ask it? Alexa, what time is it? It's as simple as you can get, right? Oh, you don't hear. Okay, they haven't got the audio on my computer set up, but it looked like it did it. So this is for people who want to know what it's like.
Ask what the temperature's like in San Jose.
Okay. Do you have my audio yet? Oh, wait. Okay, let's try it. Wait a minute. I don't have to say Alexa because I'm pressing a button. What's the temperature in San Jose?
In San Jose, California, it's 80 degrees with partly sunny skies. Today's forecast calls for more of the same, with a high of 86 degrees and a low of 57 degrees.
It's the same voice and everything. That's great. So you
it's
can
wrong.
Now...
It's wrong, though. Look.
It's wrong. Okay, we didn't ask it to be right. We just wanted to talk to it.
89 and climbing, so okay. Here we go.
Yeah, well, wait a minute. What's the weather at Kevin's house? I didn't ask the right question. I couldn't find
a forecast for that location.
that's actually better. So I was playing with something, an Echo kind of tool for developers, where you can basically program, if you open the skill, you can actually program it to respond a certain way. So if I ask, is Stacy Higginbotham awesome? Then the Echo will say, yes, she is. But I found out when trying to make that happen that it wouldn't recognize things like Stacey Higginbotham. So names were tough. I know. I was ready to like trick my family and get some self-validation.
It's not hard to write these skills. Have you tried this, Kevin? I mean, you're the programmer in the bunch.
I haven't played with these, but that was particular ones. I've played with some other bot things. So I don't have one of the gadgets, so I haven't been that excited by that one. But
well,
I'm intrigued by the Google one, because the thing for me is that the thing I don't like about it is that it is just voice. And what I've said for a while is that what I want is to say, I'll ask it a question and it'll show me the result visually. And so it being hooked up to the Chromecast makes a lot of sense. I've got Chromecast in my TV, so if it asks it a question, it can flash the reply up on the TV. That'd be great.
Well, that's what the Echo Home it shows it too. To you in the app.
Yeah, if you have the app on my Amazon Fire tablet, which I don't ever use, so I just have it sitting next to the Echo. And so, yeah, you do get a visual that way. In fact, when you're playing music, you'll get the album art and stuff like that.
Right. It's the thing that struck me is that there was a very old project at MIT called Put That There, which knew where you were in the room and knew where the screens were. So you could say, put that there and do that kind of stuff. And there's Oblong, which basically built that for businesses so that you have as many screens as you want in the room and it knows where they are. And you throw things between them with a wand that's like a Nintendo controller or something. That's the thing, that as we sort of gradually wire up the house, that makes more sense, because I've already got Chromecast in both my TVs. Having a good quality microphone that knows where you are, which these things are physically big enough to do, it could work out which one I'm at and throw it to the nearest TV. The other smart thing it could do is work out if the audio is coming from the TV or if it's coming from me based on where the sound's coming from. So that's not that... You know, as you start to put more microphones and detectors in this, it gets a better sense of the space that it's in. So sort of room level awareness becomes more a part of it.
It's kind of the genesis of this conversation is that it was the Google Home, which can do that, by the way, they demonstrated throwing something up on the TV, is just really a fancy Chromecast. And I thought that was kind of interesting, Stacey, that it's if you add a microphone to a Chromecast, you still have to have it. I guess it's still connecting to a server at Google and analyzing what you're saying and all of that. But you don't need a lot of processor on that thing just to recognize the trigger word.
You would need a couple things. You'd need a little bit of memory to kind of buffer so it can start listening and play that back. You would need a signal processor. So, I mean, everything that has voice recognition needs an analog to digital signal processor. And then, let's see, what else would you need? Because right now the Chromecast doesn't have, you need all the mics and stuff like that. And the Chromecast doesn't have that. And then you need to process some sort of algorithm that says, hey, I'm doing the math on where all these sounds came from, and that person is over there, so orient that way. But yeah,
did you say
don't.
Speaker?
A speaker?
Well, the Chromecast is connected to the TV, so it has a speaker. Well, the Chromecast is connected to the TV, so it has speakers. And the other thing that's slightly odd about these is you're playing music through basically a mono speaker sitting in the wrong place in your room, whereas I have very good speakers attached to the TV that I can play music through already. So that's the other part.
Right.
It's like, why am I buying the standalone box when I've got most of the pieces I need for this already? But the thing that the Alexa did was put in multiple microphones so they could actually spatially do spatial differentiation and do that kind of signal processing. You need to say...
Yeah, that's one thing that I don't...
That's one person speaking, that's another person speaking.
Yeah,
that kind
those array mics are amazing on the Alexa. That's something that that I presume the Google Home won't have.
Oh, no, I imagine they could put that
it
in
will.
There. I
mean, okay. That's not hard to do. It's not expensive. By the way, that person crawling under me is connecting our Echo. Just... Don't pay no attention to that. Yeah, right below you.
Pay no attention to the man under the table or the woman, I'm not sure.
So you got an Echo.
So Leo, your next home, you could install the entire house with Ray mics and get rid of the
Yeah, but box. I think, yes, of course, but that's never going to happen any more than I'm going to put a whole home surge suppressor in. It's less practical. I mean, somebody will do that, but much more likely what will happen is you'll have, like I said, a mantelpiece, and you'll have a few different things on there, and just use the appropriate trigger word. For instance, the Echo can read my Audible books and order stuff at Amazon. I doubt the Google Home will do that, but the Google Home could put stuff on my TV. I doubt the Echo will do that. So Jeff Bezos is probably accurate when he says you may have many of these. It's not you're right. talking about a science fiction future that may be a little ways off.
A trigger and an API.
Yeah,
sure, that'd be better.
An API, you're just going to use the stuff.
Sure, that'd be better.
That's going to happen.
You think there's so? We'll have a centralized server that'll know which one to talk to.
Or there'll be one thing, and you just tell. And in a way, this is kind of a disservice
because that's Allo. That's what Allo does, right?
Allo. Oh yeah. Because you could just say, hey, Amazon, order my books, and that would happen. But, you know, if you've got to remember that Amazon is actually her, Alexa, sorry. And then you have to remember that Apple is Siri and call her by name. That's right. Just really too much brain power.
No, it should be. That's to me the genius of what Google's doing is it's going to become an intermediary for you. You don't want to order for Amazon. What you want to say is get me this book at the best price.
Yeah. Well, also the other problem is for information. Brands, news brands, and information brands get totally cut out because it'll just give you the answer.
Well, but that's what's happening anyway. Nobody goes to web pages anymore. Yeah. All of this is change, is shifting rapidly. Now, on the other hand, Lisa says, why aren't we on the Echo's info list of, you know, you can say, give me my morning briefing, and there's a bunch of checkboxes with now a longer list of news sources. Why isn't our Tech News Today one of those news sources? And we're going to try to get a hold of Amazon to figure out how you get on that list. For a publisher, that's kind of like instant articles. That'd be a very useful, for an audio publisher, very useful thing to do.
And what if people's brands start becoming, right now, like you have you put design in for your masthead and all this. What if you spend a lot of effort getting a very distinctive voice?
Yeah. I don't know if you... Like so my voice.
Your voice would be ideal for me.
Hello, Stacy.
Oh, my God. That would creep me out in the morning. I'm going to need coffee for that one.
No, you want the Barry White voice. Hey, Stacy. I see you.
No, I want Sean Connery doing it.
Okay, Stacy. I've got something for you. That would be cool. Well, that's inevitable, too, right? That TomTom did that years ago, and Waze does it now.
So then you have, so then maybe the New York Times gets some sort of weird, I don't know whose voice they could commandeer. But
not Saul Hansel's, that's all. But Saul. I'm sorry, Saul. I love you, dude. He's not there anymore anyway.
Should we say how many Echoes have been possibly sold?
So
you threw me a segue and I dumped over it.
No, that's all right. This is going to be the jump over the segue show, I think. So Mary Meeker, who is now at Kleiner Perkins, Caulfield Buyer, was an analyst for a long time and is now a venture capitalist, has done for years her State of the Internet deck. And it is a 213 slide. And by the way, when Mary Meeker makes a slide, it is full of information. So there's a lot of content. I'd love to. Has any of you ever seen the speech that goes with this?
She does it? At Code?
Oh, yeah. I've watched that video.
Yeah.
I'd love to see that. All right.
Yeah, the video will be up
soon.
Maybe not. Soon. Maybe already. I don't know. But it was this morning, wasn't it?
Stacy pointed us to one of the slides. Which slide is it, Stacy? 131?
131.
That talks about the Amazon Echo. And I don't know where she gets these numbers, but how many they've sold. And you know what? I don't know. That seems a lot to me. 4 million. Right?
I feel like that's a lot.
That's a pretty good install base.
Yeah. I'm trying to think. I mean, Nest doesn't have that many.
Yeah.
And other IoT devices.
This may be the best-selling IoT device of all time.
How many Chromecasts are there?
That's a good question.
20 million, I think he said.
20. Wow.
It was in the keynote. I'll look it up, so I took notes on that. Hang on.
Yeah, and I think that Apple TV is in a similar. So that, in one way, that's why we look at things like Apple TV and Google's On Hub.
As of
20 million Chromecasts as a wedge, as an entree into some sort of home automation system, because those are going to get sold right now.
You 25 don't have, million.
That's a good number.
That's
a good number.
Not bad.
And so these
are the best Apple TVs.
Apple TVs is roughly the same, I think.
Yeah. The Echo hasn't been a consumer device until probably this holiday season.
Until the Super Bowl.
Or the Super Bowl, yeah. I mean, it came out last June, so almost a year ago is when it went on sale to normal people.
And the ads, though, the Super Bowl ads were probably its public debut, I would guess.
Alex Baldwin.
Alec Baldwin ordering cashmere socks. $400 cashmere socks, I might add.
So are they going to
upgrade llamas.
The stupid router, the Google router?
On Hub apparently is a Chromecast also, or very similar there too.
So will it be able router? To do the things that Home is doing, or is it just outmoded?
I'm
sure they can verse that. Yeah,
I'm sure they could. Here's my theory. It was like the Q or the Android. What is the other Android dopey thing they made?
Yeah, Q.
It was going to be. And then they said, you know, let's make this Home different. And sorry, On Hub, bye. I think that I think that this is going to be another one of those Google abandonware projects. I'm sad to say.
It's a good way to do things in parallel. They rather than say there's a strategy tax, there can only be one answer. They'll let several teams make different things and
let
try
them
out.
Let the better horse win.
That's terrible for hardware. I mean, it's fine when it's not even fine when it's software, but when you've actually purchased money for a thing and it stops working, that's not.
Well, cool. I did not buy the On Hub because
when it stops working, it's bad. Yeah, but I mean, the Hub should still keep working. There shouldn't be a reason for that to shut down.
It's going to work, but it was a high priced. Relatively average Wi-Fi access point, and the only reason one would pay $200 for it is if one thought it had promise, that there was more to it, because it had all these antennas and all these weird, and it had a speaker, it had all these things in it that never really got used. It had a microphone that was used once to pair it with your phone. And
it had a microphone in it? I didn't think it did.
It had that audio pairing thing, I think.
Well, maybe they'll...
It makes a noise and your phone detects it, I think.
Oh, it was the other way around. Yeah. Okay. So it had a speaker, but the speaker was then only used once. And I think a lot of people bought the On Hub thinking, there's going to be some magic here. But I've learned my lesson. In fact,
will be a disappearing act.
Yeah, that's the magic. Bye. Because Ron Amadio reviewed it, and he said, you know, this is kind of a mediocre router. It's not very fast. And which, by the way, Google disputes, I'm not going to get in the middle of that one. But I didn't buy one. I'm glad I didn't. And I think this is there may not be a strategy tax to Google's strategy, but there is a tax, and that's a user fatigue tax.
Interestingly, why isn't there a microphone in the On-Hub router? The project lead at Google replied, "We were worried about what people would think we were doing with it unless it was a clear use case." So there were actually it was like we don't want to put microphones in things because we're already people are already scared that we're surveilling them.
They dumbed it down.
That makes sense. I mean, when Google bought Nest, everyone was like, "Oh my God, Google's going to know where we are in our homes." And
out last week, Stacey, the Sonos has a speaker. The newest Sonos speaker has a microphone, I should say.
It also has
had a speaker, but it has a microphone.
It does. And so, we're waiting for their API to do something.
To turn it on.
Super cool. I don't know.
I love the idea of talking to my house. I really love the idea of somebody being my intermediary. I don't want to talk to Amazon and then talk to Google. I want somebody to, and it probably will be Google, given their investment in machine learning and AI, to
search,
which not a minor detail, to do what Allo looks like it's doing, which is their new messaging app, which is you tell it what you want, and then it figures out who it needs to talk to get that done. That's a personal assistant.
And it pulls up web content or apps or data or whatever the heck it be.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think part of that is that you do want not just a verbal response, you want a visual response too. And that's the thing that, you know, I think a lot of these bot things Alexa is like about as far as you can take a voice only response thing, and it works because there are a lot of the things you want are actually audio replies. So it works for Audible and it works for music, and it works for buying things you already know what they are. But if you actually need to choose what you want to buy, then you actually want a visual display for that. And otherwise, it sort of descends into just being IVR, and you know,
what's IVR?
Chatbots, like what you
like,
see
like,
on...
like what you get when you phone up, Comcast, and it
oh, a phone tree kind of a stupid
phone tree kind of things.
Yeah.
Interactive voice response is what it stands for.
Interactive voice response.
And the problem with those is that you know they can sort of they can't really hold a conversation. They can pull out a few keywords, and partly that's microphony, and partly that's because they were designed in a different world. But there's that. A lot of the bot stuff does descend into that. It's like, I'm trying to guess what magic word will trigger this action.
Right.
Whereas Google is actually fairly good at understanding
natural
what you
language,
mean.
Give
it,
right?
You give it a few words, yeah, because they've got the corpus of search for that, and they've got a large amount of voice search as well.
If there's a flaw with the Echo, it's that you have to know exactly, precisely what to ask for and what the syntax is, and it's often disjointed.
Simply for Siri. Siri basically has a bunch of specific voice commands and then some smart responses. And then otherwise it throws it out to a search, but it's not as good a search. So I think that what I got from that keynote at Google was, oh, you think you understand conversational AI? Guess what we've been doing for 15 years.
Right, exactly.
So that was, you know, even though they were those products that were vaporware, the technology underneath it isn't, whereas the other one's the other way around. Facebook is saying, oh, yes, we've got Messenger, and you'll be able to ask it things, but actually we've got a room full of people who are responding to it, and that's why we can't expand its user base beyond a few thousand at the moment.
I got an invitation to this. This is Finn. Sam Lesson created this. So Sam, you may remember, did my favorite project that was killed by another big company called Drop.io. Then Facebook hired him, killed it. He did the timeline on Facebook, left. His wife, Jessica, of course, runs the information. He worked there briefly, but this is what he was stealthily doing. And I just got an invitation to this. Finn fixes your phone and lets you live in the future. And okay, so here's the problem. It's $150 a month.
A month.
Oh, it's
a
like
month.
The information.
Well, I'm thinking it must be a human on the other end.
$150 a month, wow.
At that price.
Well, is that what
they probably fall back to human.
Huh? Yeah, M is humans.
They fall back to humans, though. So you do as much as you can, and then you route it to a human.
Right.
So I'm very tempted. Unfortunately, it's iPhone only. So I have an iPhone. I guess I'd put it on my iPhone. And I wouldn't keep it for more than a month, but I'm just curious what it's going to do. Should I join it just to be the guinea pig? And
just like you have to ask us. Like you're not going to anywhere.
Do it.
Do it.
So I will say there's a couple themes that are happening here, and it's worth like pulling them apart. One is the idea that voice is going to be like the best way to interact in every situation. And I don't think that's true.
No.
Cause what Kevin is saying about throwing things to a screen does make sense in a lot of cases. The other thing that we're talking about is it's worth clarifying how computers speak and not speak, sorry, understand when we speak, what they're actually doing. Because it requires a bunch of different data sets. And in some cases, like Google owns its own speech recognition engine. Amazon, I believe, licenses theirs from Nuance. So there's like little things there. And then when it actually comes time to saying, oh, this is what I heard you say, which is one process, and then applying that process to some action is completely different, like machine learning mm-hmm. process. Yeah. What Kevin was saying about Google having all this data on search is really going to come in handy, because right now the Echo it has no depth to it when you ask it complicated questions. And when you saw Sundar,
not only that, Stacey.
Oh yeah.
Sorry.
No, go.
Not only that, but it also, sorry, this is the lag is making me rude. Google also knows you as an individual. It knows things about you. It's farther along in that antecedent problem, the natural language processing. So the ability to have a real conversation is where the real war is. You have Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, Facebook reportedly all trying to do this. And I agree with you. I think your premise is right. I think you and Kevin are right, that Google is necessarily far ahead.
The piece that was odd for me about the Google Home demo was that it, the video thing at least, implied that it knew everyone in the family's calendar and would share it with everyone else in the family, which works with certain kinds of families and goes horribly wrong with other kinds of families.
Well, also, we know that it only works with one Google account, so this is a really interesting question mark. I think that that video may not have been accurate.
Well, they were implying it worked with everyone's Google account.
Yeah, but
one
account per home was what
is what they've come out with. See, this gets into like
so that
a
makes
great...
a bit more sense.
Yeah,
yeah. Because the thing they did, the thing they got a consent decree against them with bars was this presumption that the people in your address book are the people you want to communicate with, and therefore we should let them communicate with you.
Right.
And that caused all kinds of trouble with people who were trying to escape from abusive husbands and so on. And you have the same problem. The other problem with talking to your house is that it assumes everyone in the house wants to share everything with everyone else in the house. You don't actually want necessarily your private messages appearing on the TV or being spoken to the entire house, because the context depends on who's there. And one of the advantages of everyone having their own little screen in their pocket is that they can walk around and have semi-public conversations depending on who they're living with. And even getting out of the family thing, you don't necessarily trust your roommates with that kind of power over your life. So there's a structural thing there that is. The home model has this sort of conceptual, 1950s nuclear family, everyone knows everything about everyone else's life, implicitly built into it. And Amazon kind of had the same thing. Their pitch ads are this like wonderful nuclear family that shares everything. And the kids are usefully young enough for that to be plausible. But once the kids get to 18, that doesn't really map.
Here's, if you want a vision of the future, I did just pay for Finn. And here's their privacy policy. Finn is a personalized information service. The more information we collect about you, the more interesting and useful your Finn experience will be. We collect data you provide to us, as well as data from the devices you use to access the service. All of the information you provide to us may be shared with other users. Wait, what? Though we take steps...
Other users?
Yeah. Though we take steps to remove certain information that may identify you and your contacts before it's shared. If you're not comfortable sharing data with Finn as described in this policy, please do not use this service. And then there's the actual, legal 80 pages. But, if you're going to participate in this at $150, you're really kind of, you're buying in. You're buying into this. And I'm not going to pay $150 if Finn doesn't know everything about me.
True.
Only once in life did I have an assistant when I started EW. I didn't know. I couldn't manage her. I was so unused to having this idea.
Yeah.
And so I don't have that reflex of telling someone to do things for me.
I used to be an assistant when I was like 16. And they shouldn't have too many things to tell you.
What do you mean?
Well, I'm serious. after about a month, it was a friend of mine. We started out babysitting for this guy who was like an oil attorney. He was always in Kazakhstan.
Oil attorney.
I'm like, I don't know how legit this was, or if he's.
I do legal for oil. Yeah, just all you need to know.
But he would like after a month, we knew what he needed. Like we're like, oh, it's Friday, expensive.
You intuit it. Yeah. The first month is painful, but eventually you get there, right?
And, oh, man, I was going to say something about this, but now I can't remember.
I'm sorry. I interrupted.
No.
The family shared
device
idea.
Sharing. Yeah. So this is something that actually comes up a lot with our show and the Internet of Things type stuff, is the idea that the home should have an email account, which we all are like, oh, that sucks. But when you think about all of these devices, there's no way to share, what's happening is as we move computer from these personal screens to this amorphous vocal blob or even screens on the television, the idea is you're going to have to come up with a model for sharing information and then figuring out who gets what information. And we're going to get to sharing it with everyone first before we can figure out who to share what with.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is, you know, in a sense, that's how a lot of these services work. We start a lot of the web services. We started out sharing stuff globally, like blogging or, you know, like
live Facebooking your baby's birth unintentionally.
No. I mean, you would post events publicly. You know,
Finn, remind me to cancel you next month. Oh, sorry, I just didn't want to forget. Do you think Finn will remember? Do you think Finn will remind me?
There's your test.
So Andy Bao is bringing back Upcoming. I don't know if you...
What? Upcoming.org? You're kidding. So Andy, the story of that is a long and pretty and painful story. Andy Bao, who's a wonderful guy, did Waxy Links, had an invite system like Evite, right, called Upcoming. Didn't Yahoo buy it? And then he bought it back.
Right. And so what he's just launched is they've revived the archive of it.
Oh, what? So they've got all my old invitations.
So all the old URLs that resolve now resolve again. So suddenly all the links that were dead are alive again, which is kind
of
fun.
Look at this. This is the front page. You crazy bastards, what have you done? Now I have to rebuild upcoming.org.
Right. So that's the
I love Andy.
To fund it. But I put the link in the bottom of the spreadsheet, but basically, the historical archive is live. There you go. So click on that.
I'm not a backer though, so.
No, it's their public URL. Hang on, I'll find you a URL. Hold on.
Yeah, it says for backers only. Wow. So he kickstarted.
Yeah, I tweeted something. So if you go to my Twitter account, you'll see some upcoming links. Sorry.
So he kickstarted, and got $104,000 to bring back Upcoming. That's nice.
Yeah, and he's just brought back the archive, so suddenly all the upcoming links that have been dead for however long it is since Yahoo Shakedown are all back, which is kind of fun.
Wow.
See if I can find one. Hold on. Because, once you get into one, you can find the rest.
Well, should I go to your Twitter and do that?
Well, if you search for Kevin Marks Upcoming, you should find it.
All right.
On Twitter.
And so what is the... Why would I want to know about the parties you had 10 years ago?
Well, the point is it's part of the record. And he's trying to bring it... He is going to revive it back so that you can create new ones again. But the first step on the process was bringing back the old ones.
It's fascinating, frankly. All right, let's take a break and come back with more. Kevin Marks is here. We're going to find out how he was partying in 1999. But right now, he's at his house, kevinmarks.com, and the Indie Web Camp. We'll talk about that. From Berlin. What are you doing in Berlin? Are you there for a conference? Of course you are.
I'm going, Axel Springer, who I've talked about before, of Leistungsschutzrecht fame, is having a small event tomorrow about distributed content, which will be fascinating. I'm keynoting. Then I'm going to Google Newsgeist Bilbao, and then I'm going to keynote or open a Google Play event, which is very interesting these days, given all the discussion we've had about instant apps and such in London. And then I'm flying back next Wednesday, and it can be right on the show.
Well, have a fun time out there.
I'm trying.
And from Stacy on IOT.com, it's Stacy Higginbotham, our newest regular on the show. So nice to have you, Stacy. Our show today brought to you by the thing I have in here that keeps me from losing everything. It's my tracker. And, you know, actually what I do is I put the tracker, and this is such a little tiny thing, it's so nice, on my keys, but then I chain my keys to my backpack, and that way I never lose either. The tracker, you got to check this out, thetracker.com, makes losing things a thing of the past. This is the new Tracker Bravo. It is gorgeous. It's very thin, very light, and right now for Father's Day, through June 13th only, they've got a Father's Day sale, and you use a promo code TWIG, you'll get a free color upgrade, and when you buy two devices, you'll get two free. So I think if my math is correct, that's half off. Half off. Free color upgrade when you use a promo code TWIG, and two devices get two free. And you're going to want four, because you want to put them on everything. You want to put them on your keys. You want to put them on your phone. Actually, you don't need to. If you have it on your keys, I'll tell you how it can keep track of your phone. Put it on your remote control. put it on your doggy, on your kitty cat. They're light. They're easy. And what's neat about this, it's got a battery in it, so you don't have to recharge it. The battery lasts at least a year. It's always on. If you've misplaced your phone, you press a button on the tracker, your phone rings, even if the phone's silenced. Of course, the tracker software is on your phone, and it's paired to your tracker. If you would lose your keys or whatever the tracker is attached to, you just look on the tracker app on your phone, and it'll tell you where it is. It records your item's last known location on the map. But this is the thing that really, the secret sauce that really makes Tracker cool, is their crowdsourced GPS network. It's the largest crowd GPS network in the world with 1.5 million devices. If you scroll down on the webpage, Karsten, you'll see the map of all the tracker devices out there. Now, when any tracker user comes within 100 feet of your item, it's going to ping you. You'll receive a GPS update. It's like having buddies all over the country saying, I saw your keys here. They've partnered with companies like HP, allowing companies to build trackable products right into their stuff, and that'll utilize the scale of the tracker's crowd GPS network. So there'll be laptops with tracker in them and so forth. It's Bluetooth LE. That's why the battery lasts so long. They make water-resistant cases as well, so you could put it in your pet's collar. You'll never lose a thing again with the tracker. The hardest thing you'll ever have to find, the website. But I'm going to spell it for you. Make it easy. THETRACKR. There's no E. TheTracker.com. And don't miss, again, that Father's Day limited time sale. Through June 13th only. Buy two devices, get two free, and just for you, use the promo code TWIG, and you can get the color of your truck. Free color upgrade on all of them. TheTracker.com. Promo code TWIG. Love my trackers. I got many of them. Continuing on this week in Google, talking about not just Google, but, lately, a lot on IoT. I'm sorry, Stacy, to be stepping a little bit into your...
I thought that was just for my benefit, so I'd have something to talk about.
Not at all. What else in this Mary Meeker slide, this 213-page slide deck... I love this. iPhone sales may have peaked in 2015, while Amazon Echo sales begin to take off. That's interesting, isn't it? She talks about cars. And you pointed out, Stacey, you said one of the interesting things is the auto industry may be coming back to the U.S.
Yes, because we obviously went over to Japan, and now we're booming back to tech.
It's tech.
She pointed out like Uber and Google's all of the AI there. It's actually kind of cool. Yeah. I liked the Ford in the effort to create new metrics around automobiles. So instead, and I love tech metrics because they're always so hilarious to me. They're like, we'll make up something that works for us.
Right.
But instead of cars sold, Ford's talking, the CEO of Ford is quoted in there as talking about the amount of miles driven. So are they driven? But it makes sense if you're thinking about like, car sharing, Uber, or even things like Ford has this app, the Ford Pass app, where they just want to be like a concierge for your travel experience, where it helps you find parking and all these other things. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
We had a really great interview this morning with Kevin Kelly. It's a triangulation we're recording for sometime in the future. And we talked about his new book. I love Kevin Kelly, one of the smart guys, just really fun to talk to. And his book is all about the technologies that are going to change, you know, in the next few decades, and embracing those technologies like autonomous vehicles, like Uber. It was fascinating. And so a lot of these trends that Mary Meeker's talking about right now are, if you extend them out, going to change our life dramatically. He says the biggest change, and I have to say I agree with him, is that intelligence will be sprinkled into our stuff in a way kind of similar to electricity. When electricity and power generation became widespread, there was this massive era of innovation because people took their existing stuff and said, well, what happens if we electrify it? A farmer would say, well, that pump, you know, we could electrify that. And he said, you're going to have the same kind of explosive growth in the next decade as we start to put machine learning and AI into stuff all around us.
Really smart.
Isn't that interesting?
So yeah. We talk about that, again, IoT related, and like I love visualizing what my house is going to look like in 10 years. And if you think just around like intelligence into things like thermostats, you're not going to have thermostats on your wall, right? People may
Why
not
would
carry,
you? Yeah.
Yeah, people may not carry keys. I will make the controversial argument that you could actually build things without windows, like apartment buildings without windows. That's so dystopian, but in a place like China or where air quality is crazy bad, you wouldn't, you may,
that's not the fix for air pollution I would hope
no,
for
but, you know,
oh, just get rid of windows, never go outside.
But if you think about self-driving cars, this is kind of crazy, but if you could just call a car when you needed it, you don't actually need a garage because you won't need a necessarily a place to park your car. You could think about a model for cities or apartments where you have like a parking garage down underneath that has access to maybe fewer cars, but you don't own it. And if you've got a home, maybe there's like a neighborhood. I think about like neighborhood mailbox centers.
Well, and, why do you think Uber and Lyft and Didi are investing so heavily in autonomy? The last thing they want to do is have drivers. I mean, for one thing, these are taxi companies that don't own any cabs. And now what they want to be is taxi companies that don't own any drivers either. That's where the real money is.
But then they will have to own the cabs, though. They will have to own the self.
Then they'll have to own the cabs. You're right. But it's cheaper to own hardware. Yeah.
Messy people driving them.
People are messy. Yeah.
Well, but it's also a land use thing. So there was somebody sent out a stat this week that 14% of land in Los Angeles is parking.
Oh, that's in the slide deck.
What?
Yes.
And 40% is freeway.
Yeah. Yeah, well, get rid of both of those.
But you know, 14% is a huge amount if you think about it. That's I mean, it's partly because it's a very sprawly city and they don't build underground car parks. But if you have, you know, A, if you have better transit, that would help. You know, if you have a transit system like London's, then you don't need that much parking. But also, if once you start being able to build vehicles that don't need to park because they're going to be reused by somebody else, then that frees up that land as well. And that's one of those interesting, you know, theoretical future things of like, well, we can get all that land back and build these little windowless apartments that Stacey's talking about on them. And suddenly you could live in LA in a tiny box and go to the beach whenever you feel like it.
You could go to the beach with VR.
Right. And then we don't have to go outside. And so it'll be kind of like Escape from New York with Snake Plissken and a bunch of people who don't want to be inside.
Now, did you guys...
I don't know.
You know about Iceberg Homes? Have you heard about this?
No, what's this?
This is another strange London real estate trend.
I hear they're melting.
They're building in the richer areas of London. They're building strange underground homes underneath the existing ones because they're not allowed to build upwards, but they can build downwards.
That's what Bill Gates did.
These sort of strange. Right, Russian oligarch.
That's creepy.
Have like three stories of basement.
that is just creepy.
And that a bomb shelter.
Yeah, that's evil genius lair stuff.
I didn't see in this report that this is not evil genius lair, but I was looking for it and I didn't see it. Stuff on VR, which kind of surprised me given all the bets in virtual reality that people are making.
She didn't talk about that. You know, I'm starting to wonder if VR is going to be all that. I love it. It's fun. We talked Sunday, Stacey. We talked about VR sickness and the fact that it may be intractable.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That was. I didn't just dream that. We were on a show together.
Believe me, it's all going to be a blur any day now, Stacey.
Like, dear God.
Always on Twitter. I can't take it anymore. Yeah, we were talking about an expert on VR. Guy had been working for decades with the Air Force and simulators, said it's just this isn't an accident. This isn't technology is not going to make this go away. It makes people sick because they're focusing. Their brain is thinks that something's at one distance, and their eyes are telling them it's at another distance. And our caveman bodies are designed that if your eyes tell you one thing and your brain tells you another thing, that you're hallucinating and you should throw up those mushrooms you ate. And so that's why you get nauseated.
But the point is that, so there are two things to that. One is that there's actually two ways we judge visual depth. One is by Convergence. One is by, but the other thing is there's two ways even with stereoscopy. So one is we judge depth by our eyes looking at the view and deciding how far away it is. The other thing is that we move our head back and forth like that and see what moves. And historically, VR has not been fast enough to let you do that thing. And Dana Boyd did some great research on this, and there's a gender difference in how men and women perceive.
Right. She said VR. Women are really have more trouble.
Well, right. Women are more likely to try and do that, and that the old VR systems wouldn't let you do that, and so they were more likely to be nauseated by it.
So you do think it's fixable?
So it's fixable, but it needs to be, you know, the lag time needs to be low enough that you can actually use that mode. The other thing, this also comes into when you're shooting the VR video. This is the reason you have the 16 camera rigs, because that enables you to do that kind of thing with your head,
right.
Because you've actually got different camera views you can interpolate between. Whereas if you've just got an omnidirectional lens like the cheaper ones, then you've basically just got a sphere and you're looking around inside the sphere. So really you're looking around with one eye and looking around a sphere, but you're presenting with two eyes. So that is a subtle difference. The other thing that potentially will fix this is the Magic Leap and the other ones that are doing this sort of diffuse field stuff, where they can actually overlay at different distances perceptually. So that is you know, more speculative tech and harder to do, but that implies that you're not having to, you know, be focused at infinity, but your eyes being converged, because you can actually make stuff appear where you want it to appear in 3D space. So he's right in that. From what I read, he's right in that the existing systems have not bothered worrying about that, because they, as he says, they were building them for fighter pilots, and the fighter pilots are sort of pre-tuned to not get nauseous, because when they're spinning around in circles and turning upside down. But also, it's like modeling the perception stuff and saying, can this stuff be fixed? Now, I agree. Yeah, it's a practical thing that a lot of people do get made nauseous by or disoriented by these existing rigs, and it's going to take some work to get that right.
So he also says that VR sickness. In a percentage, the Air Force, and this is an Air Force and Army study, the military thought it was about 10%, takes 24 hours to dissipate. And their recommendation is whatever you do after you end your sim is not pilot a plane or drive a car, because you're going to drive into something. So that's not good. And anyway, I wonder if Mary Meeker knows something, or if she just decided not to talk about it. I don't know.
She didn't want a 400 slide show.
Yeah, maybe she just ran out of slides. Do people care about their privacy, she asks, or do they care about who has their data? This is slide 211. So I have a feeling the answer is going to come quickly. Interesting. I guess she doesn't have an answer for that. She asks, at the end, she asks the question.
You know, Pew did a study on this, gosh, maybe a couple months ago, and they talked about They offered people different scenarios on when they would share their data. So people were happy. I'm not even going to make them up, because I can't even remember that far back. But there is data on some of this. And there's also studies that show that people will give up, you know, their social security number for a cookie.
Or their password for a Mars bar.
Really? Their password
peanut
for
butter, peanut butter, I get it.
This is from January, the State of Privacy in America. I really love these Pew research. 91% of adults agree or strongly agree that consumers have lost control of their privacy. Americans express a consistent lack of confidence about the security of everyday communications channels. Why wouldn't they? That's all we're reporting on lately, is how credit card companies and government agencies are being hacked. Incidentally, those are the two that they have the least confidence in, in terms of worried about keeping records private and secure. Telephone company, cellular company, email provider, and cable TV company follow. For most Americans who are making decisions about sharing their information in return for a product, service, or Mars bar, the context and conditions of the transactions matter. This is what you were talking about. It depends. Is the answer. For instance, 54% of Americans say it'd be worth trading off having surveillance cameras in the office in order to improve workplace security and help reduce threats. But a smart thermostat that might save your energy costs and returns for insight about your comings and goings was only acceptable by 27% of adults. and not acceptable by 55%. Trouble for Nest.
I still see that as techno panic, that that'll change as you see the benefit, as you save money, once it hits your pocketbook, people will say, and they know they're controlled.
I agree with you. I think the most important takeaway is that they're paying attention to who's got the information and what the outcome is, which I think is positive. That means that there is that calculation. They're not saying under no circumstances. They're saying, well, given the right circumstances, I'd be willing to do this.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people don't understand, though, how much information they are giving up or sloughing off in their kind of digital lives, and how that can be kind of reconstituted to find out who they are, what they were doing. And I think...
Well, they're learning, and I think that's what's scaring them, and that's probably where the techno panic's coming from.
Yeah, well, and also the way they ask that question is a little crazy. That makes it sound like Nest is your parent.
Exactly. Right. Well, now, if we could follow you around, but make sure that you save energy, would that be okay?
I'm like, if anyone's monitoring my comings and goings, I'm like, you're not the boss of me.
It's just a thermostat. And Google.
And no, Nest does not share their data with Google. They're very...
Oh, really? Oh, good.
They are very clear about that because everyone's freaked out about Google.
Right. That's what makes me saddest about that.
Story.
Go ahead, Jeff.
I go back to the story from some years ago when I visited Google office in Munich, and they handled privacy there, and no one complained to them about priority inbox because the service was so valuable to people.
Yeah.
Although I will admit, whenever I'm hunting down rumors or gossip about Google, I don't use my Gmail account. So...
Will it make you feel better if Google's assistant has a backstory?
Oh, I saw that. I love that they're using Pixar people because everything Pixar creates is so warm and fuzzy, but I thought that was really...
The head of Google Doodle, Ryan Germick, and former Pixar animator Emma Coates, according to Fast Company, are two of the artists crafting the personality of the Google assistant. Well, I'm glad. I mean, we want it to be her, right?
Well, what should we do? I think this is...
Or Sean Connery.
Sean Connery.
I think...
Hello, Stacey. Wherever you'd like to go out for a little walk and a talk.
This is like genuine deep personalities, isn't it? It's we're going to get Marvin the Paranoid Android.
You're right. I'm sorry, Jeff. What did you say? I had a pain all up and down the diodes on my left side.
Well, if you're going to give it a backstory, why not give it a name?
Oh, I'm sure they will.
Why give it just one? I'd rather just say, hey, Amazon, order me some stuff. Hey, Google, find this for me. But if you're going to go through the character development. And that's creepy as all get out. Let me pick my character because I am sick of telling ladies what to do and having them like. I think it's.
You have Jarvis.
I don't know. Oh, what was that?
Jarvis Jeeves.
Yes, I could do Jarvis.
I'll take that one.
And who was it? Some VC was writing about how the Echo made his kid rude, and it's kind of worth thinking about because. You're creating these characters and I don't think that, you know, kids are going to like suddenly stop being or, you know, go feral on us because of this. But I think it's worth thinking about like anthropomorphizing these commercial constructs, basically.
Well, this was an interesting thing that Kevin Kelly said earlier in our conversation is there's a tendency to kind of think of robots and AIs as slaves. And maybe even an economic incentive to treat him that way. But he says, you know, what comes up is, do we, even with a machine, do we really want to treat a machine like a slave? And that raises ethical conundrums, especially if, as people are doing, they're teaching robots to protect themselves by having pain. You know, it would be analogous to pain. I don't know if it's pain like we have pain, but pain protects us from accidentally burning or severing a limb. Because we feel the heat. A robot needs that same kind of pain to protect itself. Now, if it feels pain, now is it okay to enslave it?
It wouldn't feel pain. It would just be like, hey, this is hotter than you can technically stand. Stop.
Right.
I mean, so...
This is what Blade Runner was about. says Reverb Mike. It was, wasn't it? If you,
there was,
these are robots that you're putting out there in the mines, except that if you give them a past, now they have memories, and suddenly.
Okay, see, yeah, you've gone off the I can't
it's
say that.
Too much anthropomorphizing?
Yes, I'll say it the for deep you. In there. Yeah. Although, so if you're concerned about this, read the profile in the New Yorker's Innovators issue on Sphero in using it to teach kids to code, because at the end they start talking about like the next gen product is going to be more like a pet
right.
for kids.
Right.
And he's like, the writer concludes with like, hey, I'd be cool with this as long as I can turn it off. And the CEO was like, yes, but if we do our job, you won't want, you'll feel bad doing that.
Yeah. So, we talked to the founder about that actually. Yeah, go ahead.
The other half of this is the sort of the other odd thing is that we trust the answers that come from the machine more than we trust the answers that come from people. So, you know, the sort of dystopic version of this is when they set up scheduling software for companies, that this became very, very bad for people because it was just scheduling for the purpose of the business, not for the purposes of the people. And it didn't have a model of, oh, it would be a bad idea to change someone's shift around every day because then they wouldn't be able to make childcare arrangements. And because the computer was giving this answer, people would accept that, oh, the computer's given us the right answer, even though it had a model that wasn't functional. So the other half of this, you know, well, we'll ask Google whether this is right or not. You know, Google gets things wrong every now and then. You know, Alexa got my temperature wrong now by 16 degrees now. You know, it's 96 degrees.
96?
Not 81.
She didn't pull it from there.
She wasn't sitting outside. Yeah, local, super, hyper, what is it, Jeff, you'd call it? Hyper-local weather.
Hyper-local,
the point, you know, if I was in one of these windowless apartments and said, oh, should I go outside? It says, yeah, it's 81 degrees. And I come outside and it's 96.
Okay, but by that time, we're going to have sensors throughout your apartment. They're going to know. That'll be fine. I'm not worried about that. But the data and people trust what these things tell them. They trust they're more likely to interact with something and forgive something. Like once you start a transaction with, you know, an AR, a human seeming character, you know, you're probably going to keep going with it. And that's great benefit to the company. You'll share more information with it because you'll trust it more. I don't know. Yeah, it's a little scary. I mean, do you guys say thank you to your Echo when she does something for you?
Sometimes, yeah.
I'm constantly doing it, so.
Yeah. I started it in jest, and now I mean it.
Yeah, you're like, oh, thanks for turning off
thank
my lights.
You.
if you tell her that, she actually will say you're welcome, I believe.
That's smart, right? So that's an interesting question.
It's going to get bad in German. You're going to end up with this Dankeschön, Bitteschön loop that never ends.
But isn't that – okay, so here's a question. Is that smart of Google to do that or Amazon to do that or not? Don't – on the one hand, they want you to anthropomorphize, right? Right? Or no? Maybe they don't.
Well, the other thing is they want these to be transactional conversations that in a human sense. So the point of the stuff Google was demoing was that they can maintain a sense of what you're talking about across more than one interaction. And so in a sense, saying thank you is a way of saying I've closed out this interaction. So that would be a useful signal for them as well.
Well, it's like a copy or 10-4. That's what it's like.
Yes.
Roger, Roger, Roger. Can't call it Roger, I guess.
Jeff,
I'm sorry. You're left out because of this lag. Go ahead and say something.
I'm trying not to join in because I don't want to join in. It's the rude moment. So no, I'm fine. I'll jump in. I'm just trying not to do what I usually do in these cases.
Oh, be rude. We miss you. where are Jeff? Who took? What did you do with Jeff? Oops. Just dropped my memory card. There are holes all over the table. Let's take a break. Come back with more. Wait a minute. I'm receiving an important notice from this 2-year-old in Alexa. We finally found this. So a week ago, I asked for this. Here is a 2-year-old, a little confused. Oh, you sent it to me. Oh man, let me do an ad and then we'll see if we can find it. Thank you. Our show today brought to you by Carbonite Online Backup. If we do have a lot of stuff on our computers, and we do, what are you doing to protect it? I hope you're backing up, but, you know, think about it. If you're backing up to a hard drive in your house or in your office, Are you really backing up? What if there's a fire or a flood or a sinkhole opens up and your house sinks in and disappears forever and you are at work and you come home and there's nothing left of your data but a giant hole in the ground? Then what will you do? What will you do? Well, if you have Carbonite automatic cloud backup, you just go to Carbonite.com and say, here's my stuff. Carbonite, for as little as $5 a month, you can back up everything on your Mac or your PC. If you're in office or if you have servers, they have plans for you, too. And the thing is, it's exactly what you want. It's automatic. You don't have to think about it. In fact, you pay once a year, and then just forget it. You got peace of mind. You can see your data if you want to see. Is it backing up? Is it there? You can log on to any computer on your Carbonite, to your Carbonite account on any computer, and there's your stuff. Or use your free apps, and then you'll see your stuff. You can restore it anytime, even if you didn't have a disaster. It's actually a great way to upgrade a computer or get a new computer. Just move your Carbonite account, download your data, you're good to go. It's continuous, too. So you change a file, boom, it's backed up. This is really important for ransomware. So if if you're a Windows user, you got to worry about this. This is a plague. Viruses that get on your system, encrypt your data, and then hold it up for ransom, saying, send us, 40 bitcoins and we'll unlock your data. Well, you don't want to send them money. You want to have your data. Don't be like that hospital in Southern California that paid ransomware hackers $17,000, not to mention the privacy violation fees, the HIPAA fees that they're going to be paying, all because they didn't have a good backup solution. With Carbonite, because you've got versioning, you just say, hey, don't restore that version, the one before it. That's the good one, and you're good to go. Carbonite is awesome, and it's always off-site. That's the other good part. Nothing can hurt your data. It's safe. It's on vacation. It's got its feet up. It's relaxing in the climate-controlled operations center at the Carbonite Cloud. Just taking it easy. But when you need it, it's ready to go right back to work for you. Go to Carbonite.com. Try it free right now. Do use our offer code TWIG. That way you'll get 2 months free when you purchase. No credit card needed for the free trial. Just give them. That way you don't have to worry. They don't have your credit card yet. But if you do decide to buy, and I think you will, use the offer code TWIG. 2 months free. The only way, to back it up. If you're going to back it up, do it right with Carbonite. Kevin Marks is here. Jeff Jarvis, Stacey Higginbotham. We're talking about the cloud, the Google, the Facebook, the chatbots. What are progressive web apps, Jeff? And I don't know if I like
it. So that's what wowed me. Kevin will get into this too. But I got wowed by that at I.O. If you go to WashingtonPost.com, only on your phone, not on laptop, unfortunately, if you go to WashingtonPost.com/PWA, you will see not only AMP at work, where it's lightning fast, but you'll also see that the thing basically downloads an entire kind of edition of the Washington Post, and you can use it offline using something they call service workers that is a middleman between the browser and the server that can do things like cache content. And so I don't need to go to the Washington Post app anymore. If I use the PWA, it's really pretty damned amazing. And so I got all confused after I.O. And as we talked about it on the that day from I.O. I was talking to somebody from Google today, in fact, in prep for the event I'm doing next week. And by the way, Google does not pay me to do events. They pay expenses, but they don't pay me anything. I'm not on the payroll. And he said, yeah, we recognize it's, what are we doing? We're killing the web, we're making the web better. We're killing apps, we're making apps better. The combination of PWA and instant apps is very confusing for how we kind of chunk things up.
So these are articles.
Extremely fast.
So I tap it, boom, and it's in there. Brilliant. Boom.
And you can swipe left and right to get the next one.
Oh, and it's there right away, too. That's actually a great experience. Look at that.
There's navigation at the top. You can go to another section.
So now put it in airplane mode.
Okay, really? It's not going to work anymore, is it?
Oh, you have little faith.
Oh, wow.
It's already loaded.
So it's pre-cached. It's pre-fetched all this stuff.
Pre-caching.
Yes. So if you click on those.
Wow, but it's done a lot. I mean, all these articles are still live, and I'm off.
Yeah.
Oh, wait a minute. I'm still on LTE. Hold on. Let me completely turn off everything.
Yeah, basically what happens is it grays out the ones it hasn't got cached.
Okay.
So if you go back to the top,
Go to the far right on the nav bar and see what's
You'll see that there are some blue ones and some blue ones.
Oh, yeah, offline. But it did get tech.
It got most of it.
It got a lot of it. Holy
because
cow.
You click through a bunch of tabs, it's got a lot of stories. And the nice thing is the stories are really small because they're stored in AMP. And, and they don't have advertising on, which is the other reason this thing is so responsive.
Yeah, right. No ad tech really can make a difference. Why would Google do that?
So I'm
Oh, they'll add that in, but will they? Because
Of course. Oh, this is AMP.
You can AMP add content. It's just
they can add ads back in. But the point is, that, you know, and also this is There's you don't need to log into the Washington Post to see the stories, which is also another improvement over the
Because my subscription has expired, so very happy about that.
But basically this is doing a combination of things. It's the AMP thing, which is putting the pages into this very compact form that's designed to be dynamically loaded. And it's also the service worker idea, which is the progressive web app of being able to do stuff offline first. And there's two very good talks about this on the I.O. site. And I'm going to try to remember people's names, and I can remember their Twitter handles. The Jaffa the Cake and...
that's his real name, not his Twitter handle, I'm sure.
That's his Twitter handle. And slightly late, so yes.
Slightly late and Jaffa the Cake.
slightly late is Alex. What the hell is
it's
Jaffa
all right. I don't, no, no. Look, if you have a Twitter handle, and that's fine. That's your name. As far as I'm concerned, we can't be expected to remember your real name, too. He's looking it up.
Jake Archibald, yes.
Is Jake Archibald the Jaffa the Cake?
He's Jaffa the Cake. Okay. Slightly late is Alex.
Okay.
So anyway, so the point is what they've done, what they've been promoting with this, and the infrastructure's been being built into web standards for the last few years, is that the idea of the service worker is that it can run when the browser window isn't open. So it'll run in the background, and that lets it do various things. One of the things it lets you do is...
Download websites you never intend to go to before you get there.
No, well, it has to be within the same domain. So it has to be...
Okay.
You know, it can't just go down arbitrary URLs. It can only work within...
I'm not a fan of prefetching, though, right? I mean, that's especially on a mobile bandwidth where you may be paying by the byte.
It's very light.
It's light. Okay.
If you're just fetching light pages like this, then it makes sense. Yes, if you're prefetching like ridiculous giant images or ridiculous ads, then yes, it would be bad.
Right. The other thing this does, even when you're not offline, if your connection is horribly slow, it'll make the experience better.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. So the point is that it lets this thing, the service worker can run, and it can intercept all the URLs for your site and check its cache first. So when you first run it, it caches the skeleton of the page, and then as you were clicking through those different tabs, it was loading all the stories within that tab and pre-populating the cache with those. So then when you went offline, they were there already. But the other thing that means if you're on the bar and you're going underground and the thing's disappearing, you can still carry on reading. It still feels responsive. And so that's part of the point is it's in control of the cache. And if you design the apps carefully, then they will run offline as well. The other thing it will let you do is because it can receive, you can receive notifications, and then it can wake up and show you the notifications. And then the other thing that it lets you do is install it on the desktop as if it was an app. And it will prompt you to do that if you've used it a few times. So then you get an icon like, you know, get the Washington Post icon, like there on the bottom right somewhere, there.
And you got that not because you downloaded an app, because you'd read enough Washington Post pages that it decided you wanted it.
Well, you can manually do it. I think I manually did it. But
But it would do it automatically as well.
It would do it automatically, yes.
See, I'm not sure I like that.
No, it'll give you a prompt.
Okay.
So if you open
That's the prompt
times,
we already hate, where you go to a web page and says, it'd be so much better if you had the app.
No, but in this case, all it does is put the icon. You've already got the app. So there's no actual download in the app delay. It just puts the icon on your homepage.
Mm.
So if you keep using the Washington Post thing, eventually you'll get a little pop-up at the bottom. And it'll say, do you want to keep this on your homepage? And you go, yes.
Well, you're Mr. Open Web, so you're okay with this.
Yeah, well, there was a certain amount of fuss about it this week, post-IO, because debating about when they can be full screen and what happens to URLs then. They're still trying to work that piece out. So the challenge is once they're full screen, then you lose the URL bar. The other thing is that's different is that on Android N, on Android M, every web page shows up in the previous list thing at the bottom, the little square, if you call that button. With Android M, Chrome shows up as a tab on its own, and then inside Chrome, you have it has its own tab of the pages of the that are inside there and open. You see, I'm not sure it's a bit hard to do this, but I'm facing the other way. The other thing, once these apps are installed, they get their own position in that previously visited thing. So the Washington Post is there as a first class app in that list as well. So it's blurring the distinction between what's an app and what's a web page, but it's doing it in a useful way, in that it lets you start from a web page and progressively enhance it with these features. So the thing still behaves as a web page, but when you go to it on your phone, you get this extra useful behavior. And the offline stuff works in the service workers works in Firefox and in Chrome on the desktop as well, and in the Samsung browser and Opera, because those are all based on the same code base. As yet, not in the Safari browser, and it's projected to come into Microsoft's browser, Edge.
And also, I talked to somebody today from Google about instant apps at the same time. So as right. we remember from I/O, you go to a web page, it has a link now. The link, the URL, can go straight into an app and pull it up. And so, you know, I asked, what's the value to, let's say, media? And he said, well, this way you could have a deep experience like 360 or something else you couldn't do on a web page, or transactions or outside your app, you can now pull onto the web. And the question is, does this make apps you more likely to download the app because you enjoyed it, or less likely to download the app because you don't need it? Don't know yet. Yeah. But I think at some point you're not going to know whether you're in an app or the web going forward.
Right. I mean, that's to me, the end game of this all makes sense, but which is that this is kind of all part and parcel of the same idea, where you just get what you want, and there's no more siloing. It's just you get what you want. I just worry that it going to only be the big publishers that benefit from this? I mean, how? I guess if you're on WordPress.com, you'll be all right, because they have instant or whatever it is.
Oh, I was going to ask, how hard is it for developers to implement? I mean, like, because, you know, one of the issues for publishers is they're like, oh, we need an app, we need a web page, we need this kind of app, and now they've got to support Facebook, and now this. I mean, like,
this may take away the need to do an app.
Well, yes, I see that for the limited number of people. It's for people on Android, yes?
Yes.
Yeah, so, I think PWA will work on Chrome anywhere, but Instant Apps only works on Android, I think.
Right.
And Apple people don't really use Chrome because it's not the default browser.
But also, it'll work on Chrome on iOS, because Chrome on iOS isn't really Chrome.
It's WebKit. Yeah.
Apple's browser wrapped in WebKit. So we're going to have to wait for Apple to put this into WebKit for it to work on iOS.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it's a web standard. They may pick it up. It is an advantage thing, but you don't know with Apple. Apple doesn't have a published roadmap for these things, so we just need to keep asking them for it. In terms of how hard it's not actually that hard to do. Various people in the indie web community have been working on, like, how do I add these kind of progressive web app stuff to my app, and how do I make it enhance to my site, and how to make it an enhancement. And it is the minimal version of it is fairly straightforward. Just adding the caching thing is about a page of code, and you have to think about the logic a little bit to make that work. But it's a doable thing, and it's something that I'm starting to see people are sort of putting it together as part of their web presences, and it's not like, oh, I've got to spend 3 months learning a framework. It's much more like, oh, there's a few straightforward calls that I can create a service worker, and I can write some fetch call, some fetch tracking to see what I want to cache, what I don't want to cache. So it's some code, yes, but it's the kind of code that you can embed into things. So I expect we'll start seeing it in things like Known or WordPress or these other tools over time.
Good. Stacey and I don't really. I won't speak for you, Stacey. I have no idea what you're talking about. So. I can't tell if this is good or bad. I really can't. I mean, it's on the surface of it good, because everything's fast and it works kind of offline.
It's a good experience.
It's a great experience. I can't tell if this is good for the web ecosystem. I depend on you for that, Kevin Marks. And if you like it, I like it.
Well, it's one of those. The interesting thing is Google launching these two sort of complementary things at the same time, which was
the instant apps and the BWA. Yeah.
And this is.
How is instant apps? Instant apps is the idea that when you need an app, let's say OpenTable that isn't installed, it just takes enough of that app to do what you needed it to do.
Yes.
So it seems to me to be most useful with a bot.
It's a packaging model. So the point of that is that it's triggered by a search result.
It's a URL. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So it's
also a URL to an element that is in an app that is in a different experience. So you can now basically deep link into and pull from an app.
Right. But it's actually making it more functionally useful. So part of this is what this is trying to do is to get away from the I've got to download an app model to the I can link to things with URLs and things will work. It's like URLs as the power. And we had a bunch of attempts at this last year that involved I'll route all my URLs through Facebook or I'll route all my URLs for Apple. And this is stepping back from that and saying I can route the URLs and they will get directly to the application in one of two different ways. Now, the progressive web apps, it's directly URLs. You're loading a web page, and then in the background, the web page is caching some stuff and doing some more work. So there's still an initial URL load. With the app stuff, there's a bit more magic you have to do to set up the apps and feed them into the search results so that they will show up there. So there are fewer of those that exist. And plus, you've got to refactor your app and create it in such a way that it can be loaded in smaller pieces. So you've basically got to still build an Android app, and you've got to build it in a particular way for that to work. Whereas the website one is, I've already got a website, I can add some code to the website that enhances it in this way. So, you know, it depends what you have. If you've already got an app, then you may be better off starting with the instant app stuff. If what you've got is a website, then the progressive web apps will make more sense for you.
What about all the apps that want you to go? I mean, like, I can't tell you how often I'm like, download the app. Nope. If you don't have, like, Yelp, for example, if you don't have the app, you can't read a lot of reviews. So is there an incentive for them to do this?
Because it's sampling, yes. So the idea is, that Google says, is can you get enough? Wherever you measure the engagement, do you get more engagement?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, and the question is, why is Yelp doing that to you? That's Yelp being annoying and driving you away part of the time. So they have built a model that the app install is the thing they want you to do, and then they're trying to entice you to doing that through some other way. So this gives them two alternative pathways to that, which is they could install part of the app for the app thing, or they could make the web part of Yelp more productive and useful. The challenge is what Yelp actually wants is probably to be on your phone so it can sit in the background and work out where you are and sell that information to people to throw ads at you.
Right.
So that's probably why they want the app installed. I don't know. I haven't got Yelp installed. I don't know if it tracks you in that way. But that my guess would be part of the reason you want to have an app running is that you can do that kind of surveillance.
So it gives more power to Google because it's going to give the data. They're going to collect more of the data. You're going to be less inclined to actually download. And I'm fine because I look at everything as a consumer, and I hate downloading apps to get a piece of information. But if you're a company building based on trying to sell my user data, that's going to put you in a bind. Yes?
Right. Yes, possibly.
So does Google get more or less?
Say again?
Does Google get more or less data? I mean, one thing that they said to me today was that if you're using instant apps, that will prevent you from, they prevent you from doing two things. One is notifications, because you didn't really sign up for the app to get notifications. And number two, the developer can't get the IMEI and other data that they could otherwise get if you downloaded the app. So they're protecting the consumer there from giving over information for just getting a chunk of the app as if it were a web page.
Right.
Right. Then that means someone who wants to get that data, like a publisher or the app developer isn't going to really want to do this. They won't want to build their app.
Unless you sample, good question. Unless you find that the sampling, the reach you get, if you get four times more people to try it at all, and a quarter of those download the app, are you net ahead or not? And we don't know yet.
Right. And that's, you know, that's the same thing. You know, that's the trade-off I was saying about the Washington Post app. The Washington Post app is great because it's so much better than the Washington Post experience as a person who doesn't subscribe to the Washington Post. But also, you know, this is you know, part of the reason that AMP exists is that the publishers have sort of, you know, shot themselves in the foot with, or shot us in the foot every time you open the page. It's like I've opened a page, and somewhere like in a third of the screen is the thing I was trying to read, and then everything else is covered up by ads. And click this to see the actual story, and here's some more outbrain nonsense at the bottom, and here's, you know, and the actual thing that I went there for isn't there. So this is solving the user experience problem very, very well, but it's not. It hasn't yet provided them with a parallel revenue stream. Now, the thing is, those revenue streams are going away. That was another thing that was in the Mika thing, was number of people running ad blockers on mobile is going up very strongly because the mobile experience has been destroyed by this. And also because a big contributor to your mobile data bill, you know, particularly if you're in a place where you have a mobile data bill that's not bundled, is all this rubbish that's downloaded in the background that is just trying to sell you stuff, rather than the thing you're actually trying to download in the first place. So part of this is trying to remake that bargain in a way that's useful for both parties. And the challenge is making that, you know, remaking that bargain so that the idea isn't, oh, we'll surveil you so we can get another 0.2 on our advertising thing. Because the other half of that is the surveillance-based ads don't actually perform that much better.
Right.
We're gonna take a break because Jeff has to go, and I don't want to lose him without a number. So if you can give us a few more minutes, Jeff.
Oh, absolutely.
The back of the book, the numbers and the tips. And I've got a little something with a grid on it to show you. But first, ooh, it says Google. A word from my new clothing supplier. I love the Ministry of Supply. Actually, these are, you know, I find these fascinating because this is clothing designed by MIT graduates. You know, this is high-tech clothing, a performance professional menswear company that launched at MIT a couple of years ago. They make work clothes, business clothes, that are engineered by MIT-trained engineers to provide technical benefits. Body temperature regulation to keep you from getting too hot or too cold. Sweat-wicking fibers to keep you dry. Stretch so you can move freely. Take a look at the Aviator 2 suit. That's on the left there. Ministry of Supply co-founder Jihan broke the Guinness World Record for fastest half marathon in a suit. He was wearing the Aviator 2 suit because it's a suit. It looks sharp. You can wear it to work, but it's designed around a human body in motion, not static form like traditional suits. Instead of woven fabric, it's got this really nice, and I actually love this because I have some shorts made out of this same material, warp knit material. It's exceptionally lightweight and flexible, and it's very practical. You should get some of these, Jeff, because you travel a lot.
I'm hooked. I'm looking.
Stretchy material retains the structure and shape while enabling extreme movement and flexibility. You know, their clothes are easy to maintain. They're wrinkle resistant. You can wash and dry them at home. No need to iron. No dry cleaning. For a traveler, these are awesome. But they look sharp. The Gemini dress shirt. I got that one right here. This is a traditional cotton dress shirt for men, but it's a little bit, it's blended cotton, so it feels like cotton, but it's got temperature-regulating phase change materials in it. This is a NASA invention that stores and releases body heat based on the surrounding climate. What? Plus, they have like things like laser-cut ventilation at the underarm, so your air, it keeps flowing there, you keep cool. It's a dress shirt that looks completely classic, looks beautiful, but it is high-tech. It keeps you a steady, comfortable temperature all day long.
And Ministry of people from MIT could be fashionable. They are.
Well, it's a kind of fashion. It's kind of like Pied Piper fashion. You know, it's like cool. It's Silicon Valley fashion. Look at this. I love this sweater. This is a they're telling me I should pronounce this merino wool sweater with coffee is in the fabric for deodorizing. I don't know any nicer way to put this. It's a beautiful. They have tees. They have sweaters. MinistryofSupply.com/twig. If you use the offer code twig, you'll get 15% off your first purchase. Shop now. The offer expires at the end of the month. This will be good for Father's Day or grads. You know what's great? Graduate from high school, get your suit. I did. We got my first suit. I went to Brooks Brothers. Nowadays, the kids, they should go to MinistryofSupply.com/twig. Offer expires end of the month. They're shop in person in one of their stores in Boston, San Francisco, coming soon to D.C. You can do it in the store. You can do it online. But you mention TWIG, you'll get 15% off your first purchase. Ministry of Supply. Menswear made smarter. Jeff Jarvis, your number of the week, my friend.
So The Atlantic did a piece a couple days ago on how many stories do newspapers publish every day.
I saw this.
Washington Post.
Mind-boggling.
It is. I'll give you the numbers first. Washington Post publishes an average of 1,200 stories, graphics, and videos per day. That is to say, chunks and elements. The Post editorial staff produces about 500 stories per day. I think The Guardian runs around 300-400. New York Times says they produce 150 articles a day during the week, 250 on weekends, plus 65 blog posts a day, 330 basic graphics a month, and so on. So Times roughly 230 pieces of content per day. That number has risen by more than 35% in the decade. And so on. And the point here is that that's a fine thing. They produce all kinds of stuff, but no human being can read it all. Yet what do we do in the architecture of news sites? We still have a homepage that promotes, maybe 2% of that amount. And we look at it and think, okay, I know what the Post had today. Same with the Post app. Same with the Times. All of them are the same. The structure we have of getting people to the news they want is antiquated, irrelevant, mass media, one size fits all. And even the editor stuff, how do they expect us to say that we're informed to know what's what based on this? So it's just a little eye-opening about how much stuff we produce constantly. It's almost as many podcasts as you make in a week.
Yeah, a lot more expensive. I mean, imagine the cost in that newsroom.
A lot of it's content that you can churn out in like 30 minutes. Just a Me Too.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I'm like,
no, the journalist speaks.
Yes. Yep. You're right. It's wasted effort.
Well, maybe not. It's kind of like demand media for the dead tree world. Set. Yeah.
Right. Well, when you want traffic's sake, you do what Stacey says. Yes. You just rewrite everybody else.
Yeah. It sucks. It's terrible.
You go in terrible circles. We now each story has 20 versions. So we had that with that Google story. It's like we linked to one version, but the actual story was somewhere else.
From the chat room comes a number, Theranos. Elizabeth Holmes, who's the founder of Theranos, listed as the richest woman in the world in the latest lists of rich people. But has been downgraded. Time magazine has downgraded her because it was based on the value of Theranos stock, she has 50% of what was $4 billion. Now that Theranos...
$9 billion.
Was it Forbes or Time?
It was Time.
Okay.
No, Forbes.
I thought it was
announced.
Forbes.
Was it Forbes? Okay, I was just... Hey, I'm going
Hold
by
on,
the...
Let's get our story straight here.
There it is. The Forbes has downgraded her. They've revised her estimated net worth from $4.5 billion to nothing because, unfortunately, Theranos is under investigation and the stock is, the company, it's not a publicly held company, so it doesn't have a public stock price, but it's kind of widely thought that the value of Theranos is not quite $9 billion.
Well, but also the money like she's taken has liquidation preference, which means that... it's gone to below the point where she can get any money out.
It doesn't go to her. It goes to the investors first.
Yes. But before we attack Elizabeth Holmes or this, let's just say this just makes a mockery of these lists to begin with.
Right.
I mean,
it's made up anyway.
True that.
Yeah.
True that.
Thank you. Stacey, you got anything you want to share with us? A tip, a product, something you like?
I do. So in people may know about this. I just found out about it because actually I read about it in the New York Times, which is a surprising place to read about technology from like new technology, but it's an app called Side Chef. And it's awesome. I like to cook and I always download stuff. I don't download it. I do it from my iPad, usually in the kitchen. And then I'm constantly like wiping my hands off to touch the screen to get to the next thing. So what this does is the recipes are pretty limited, but you set it up. It does a slideshow for like when you add each ingredient, and you can actually use your voice to say next, and then it'll just move right ahead. So I love it. I can show you on mine if you don't want to log in.
This looks very cool. Yeah, show us your screen.
All right, here we go. This is. Can you see that?
Yeah, it's too bright. It's very bright. Yeah.
Sorry.
Pull up the thing from the bottom and then slide the thing over in the. There we go.
Pull up the thing from the bottom.
Are you an iPhone or Android? I'm sorry.
I'm on an Android.
Pull the thing down from the top and slide the thing over. It's all the same. Top, bottom, it's the same.
It's the same thing.
Well, on an iPhone, it's at the bottom.
It's a similar thing, yeah.
That's a similar thing.
Right. Is that better? Sort of?
Yeah. Now I can see it. Wait a minute. You're making a grapefruit bourbon cocktail?
Yes, because they're fast.
Yum.
So this is what it does. Hold on.
The water, 1/2 cup, and sugar, 1/2 cup in a pan.
Oh, it walks you through it.
Yes, and I'm trying to put it in front of my screen. There.
Left is right, and right is left. Up is down.
All right. So it gave me that. It told me. It read it out loud to me. Next. I don't know if it'll do it. Next. Okay, hold on.
I understand the idea. Yeah. So if you're talking too much, you obviously is going to get confused. But
oh no! Each time you do a recipe, you have to turn your voice activation on. Oh,
okay. Each time.
But you do this like once a day, right?
Right.
So it's using up battery power.
This is great. Oh, I see.
Yeah.
This is great.
Yeah.
So the idea is a hands-free cookbook.
Yes, and I would love for them to integrate with more. Recipes, like if they put this on all recipes, I would actually pay money for that.
Too.
That would be wow.
Yeah, because okay. I have 100 cookbooks and I don't use them. I look it up on the web and then, but this is nice because it walks you through. It's like a little side chef sitting next to you. I'm installing it right now. Thank you.
So try it out. See if y'all.
And it's free.
It is free.
What?
But if I'm serious, I would pay for this. Is like total utility. Totally would pay for it if it had more stuff.
$2,500 is pretty good. Does it have like the basics, or is it like all weird stuff? You know what I'm saying?
I eat a lot of weird stuff, so
combine the water 1/2.
It's talking. Continue to make your grapefruit bourbon beverage.
Stacey, eat your drink.
Kevin, do you have anything you want to tell us? Indie Webcamp, what's going on?
Yes, there's lots of Indie Webcamp news this week. So IndieWebcamp.com has the details, but there's Homebrew Website Club tonight in San Francisco and Los Angeles, I think. Not in Portland this week. There was one in Göteborg and Brighton, but those are done. Also this weekend coming up is the Indie Web Summit in Portland, and that's a two or three-day conference, depending on which bits you go to, where you gather with other indie web people, discuss your website and things you want to build, and then build them and share them. So that's this weekend in Portland. If you're in the neighborhood or can get to Portland this weekend, there are still some places available for that.
Very nice.
So, there's a link at the top there. Says Indie Webcamp Summit, June the 4th.
Yeah.
And you can... And this schedule.
All right, Leo, I'm dying to see your swag. Bye.
Yeah. You want to see my new Google case. Well, first of all, we talked about this the other day. These are those cases.
So one more thing.
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, sorry, Kevin. Sorry.
So the other thing is that WebMention, the specification for telling a website when you've linked to it, has got to candidate recommendation at the W3C.
That's wonderful.
We've already built a bunch of implementations of it, but now we're out seeking more implementations. And the best way to test that, there's a site called webmention.rocks. And if you go there, that will tell you how to test your webmention implementation and send and receive them and show you if it works.
It's a validator. So, awesome. That's congratulations. That's a big deal, getting W3C.
Right.
So we're working through that, and we've got other stuff coming through the social web working group. There's a social web face to face in Portland this next week as well. Trying to get more of these standards through, but WebMention is the first one to get candidate recommendations.
So WebMention is kind of like the track back for the 21st century, kind of. It's
yes. So basically, if I post something and link to you, and you have WebMention on your site, I call it and say, hey, I've linked to you, and then your site can go back and see what did that link mean? Was it a like? Was it a reply? Was it a RSVP to going to the conference and that kind of thing? So it's a way of sending the information between sites directly without them having to crawl each other. We've already got something like 20 implementations done, and we're working to bring them to some of the larger sites as well. But it's definitely at the state now where we're reasonably confident with how it works, and we want more implementers to try it out. So if you're coding, do that.
Very good. We talked. I don't know if you were here or not, Jeff, when we talked about these cases. They're on the Google Store.
Yeah, you ordered one. Yeah,
and I ordered one. There's a couple of different ways you can do this. I got a map one. This is Paris. You know who spotted this map? This is from Google Maps. You know who spotted this? Is Paul Thorat. He said, "Is that Paris?" I said, "What?
Oh,
how could you know that?" He says, "Because I got the same map on mine, except his is blown up a little bit more."
That's the periphery, yeah.
Yeah, you could see right there. There's the, and then. So the idea is you specify the map. You can make it anywhere you want. It could be your home. These things come with a NFC chip built into the back. So let me pry this off my, this is for the 6P. I don't know if they make them for the, they must make it for the 5X. But
I don't know. I think it's just 6P.
I think it might just be the 6P. Oh, I know.
My girlish hands cannot handle these giant phones here.
I know. It's kind of like it's they're discriminating. All right, I won't take that one off because I can't. But this is the Jeff Koontz one. Remember the they've used artists in the past. Last year, I can't remember. But I decided to go with Diana because that's pretty, Princess of the Hunt or whatever she is. And then here you can see very easily. There's the NFC chip. Now, the idea is you press, there's a little raised an indent on here that you press it, but you have to press it really hard, and then it will, the live case will launch the live case app on your phone, and then you can have a appropriate slideshow, you know, of classical art or maps or different wallpaper and whatever. But my experience has been, and Mary Jo said this as well, she has... you got to press it like hard and see, it's not even seeing the tag, and don't get it for that reason. It's kind of dopey, but it's a nice case. This would look better on a whiter 6P or maybe the gold 6P. It doesn't look so great on the black one because it's such a light case, but there you go.
Oh, I think it says Nexus 5X 6P or 6.
Yay, Stacy can get it. But
I think I'm reading that in German, so I'm not sure.
I'm not sure if I would recommend it. I would recommend it as a nice little thin light case. I'm not sure that the live case feature works all that well, because you see, I pressed it and it got nothing. And you also have to press it really hard. So it seemed like a good idea at the time. I'm afraid I'm going to break my phone. There we go. Okay. See, so now I could, I get to choose my, my wallpaper. I can say, okay, I'm going to have this be the wallpaper. Tap that location and it should change it, but I don't know.
Yeah, that feels real gimmicky.
I'm on marshmallow, nut roll. So maybe it's a nut roll issue. I don't know. And you can have the locations of the places that you want to see. Yeah, it's a kind of dopey, isn't it? Well, we had to try it out. Stacy says, I don't want it anyway. That's what we do.
That's what you do.
I've got a clear, thin case. I'll probably.
That's all you need. Yeah. I think you almost don't need a case on the 6P and the 5X. They're pretty robust phones, unlike the Galaxy S7, which is made of glass.
I drop my phones all the time, so I case them.
Maybe if you had a fewer grapefruit bourbon drinks, it wouldn't be such a problem for you.
That could be my problem.
Actually,
right.
I want one now.
I was going to switch out the bourbon for gin, though. So.
Ah, grapefruit gin. That sounds perfect.
It's hot here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where is here again? Where are you, Stacy?
Austin.
Austin. It's really hot. #MyLiveCase. Don't buy it. Okay. Thank you, Stacy.
Thank you.
Stacy Higginbotham. Botham. Stacy on IOT.com. And, of course, the IOT podcast with Kevin Toefel. And that's every Tuesday. She's on our show. I'm happy to say every Wednesday. Great to have you. Welcome.
Yay.
Also to Jeff Jarvis, who is here every week. He can make it. He's in Berlin today. Be back next week.
I hope I'll be there next week if United Airlines cooperates. I'll be there.
Always a question.
I'll be rushing into the show.
Well, good. I look forward to seeing you again. You too. Kevin Marks, IndieWebcamp.com, where it is. How? What hot? Raise it a little higher. 96 degrees. Is that your, wait a minute. Is that your body temperature or the weather?
It's
weather.
Cooler in Austin.
96.8 degrees in San Jose. Oh, my God. Well, stay cool.
97.
It's going up. It's going up. Pretty soon it'll be 98.6, and you can take your skin off. I don't know what that means. That's meaningless.
I need those shirts you were selling, clearly.
Yes. I'll send one down to you. It'll be too late. We do this show every Wednesday, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. Join us live if you can. If you want to be in the studio, we have a nice studio audience today visiting from the UK. All you have to do is email tickets at twit.tv. We'll put a chair out for you. And, of course, if you can't be here live or watch live, you can always do it on demand because we've got audio and video for you to download and listen to at your leisure at twit.tv/twig or on your favorite podcast app. Thanks for joining us. I'm Leo Laporte. We'll see you next time on This Week in Google.